Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. Trust in others. Does religion matter? That is the title of a recently published article in the Review of Social Economy and is the focus of our attention today on Research on Religion. The topic of trust has been of growing interest to many social scientists over the past three decades and crosses a wide range of academic disciplines, including sociology, political science, and economics. It has been widely observed that the extent of trust one puts in friends, neighbors, persons of authority, such as elected officials or the police, or even our trust in total strangers, can have a large impact on how society operates. Political scientists, such as Robert Putnam, have been concerned about whether low levels of trust in society lead to dysfunctional governance. Sociologists tend to be interested in whether or not various social categories, such as racial or ethnic groups, trust one another and what impact this might have on societal tension and conflict. And economists are increasingly exploring whether higher levels of social trust can help reduce transaction costs in society and promote greater economic growth. Given the central role that religion plays in fostering social norms and teaching people about how they should interact with others in society, it is not surprising that studies on trust would consider religion to be an important topic of study. To address what role religion might play in fostering trust and how it might affect our attitudes in other areas of economic life, such as support for international trade and immigration, I'm pleased to be joined by one of the co-authors of the aforementioned article, Joseph Daniels. He's a professor of economics at Marquette University and also the director of the Center for Global and Economic Studies. He also has been recognized with various teaching awards at Marquette University. So we're going to know that this guy is really good at presenting his ideas. Joe, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure to talk with you today.
Well, as you may or may not know, Marquette is my undergraduate alma mater there. So I have to ask, how are the Warriors doing in basketball this year?
Well, I hate to tell you, Tony, but Warriors is not politically correct. We changed the name to Golden Eagles.
It's the Golden Eagles?
Yeah, the Golden Eagles.
Maybe that's why
Maybe
that's why all my alumni checks haven't been getting there or something. I put Marquette Warriors on there. Okay, all right, so they're the Golden Warriors. But how about the Packers? We are recording this right now, about 2 weeks away from the Super Bowl. I just watched the Packers-Bears game yesterday, and I know that you're living in Wisconsin now, so you have to be a Packers fan. Thoughts on the Super Bowl?
I'm a cheesehead now.
You're a cheesehead. Any thoughts on that Packer game coming up?
Hey, I'm picking the Packers.
Yep, I'm picking the Packers to win, too. And what's neat about this is since we're recording it 2 weeks ahead of time, see how empirically correct our predictions were. So, all right, I want to also note one other Marquette connection that we have here. Your co-author on the article that we'll be discussing today is another Marquette alumnus. His name is Mark Vonderer, and he was recently featured on Research on Religion a few months back talking about the economics of megachurch recruitment and retention. And so I refer folks back to that podcast as well, because you guys work together writing some really interesting research here. So let's move now to the topic of trust. And as I noted in the introduction, the study of trust has really become a growth industry in academia. And while some of our audience may have some familiarity with this topic, others may not. So let's begin with you giving me an idea about what trust is and why it is so important to study it.
Yeah, usually in a presentation, that is always one area of difficulty, is to actually define what we mean by trust. It has a number of different dimensions, but, you know, it's basically reciprocity. You know, do I believe if I put faith in you, you're not going to harm me? I do this for you in the future, will you do that for me? So, you know, it has this component of reciprocity. Mm-hmm. There's not a clear-cut definition of what trust happens to be, and so we have to kind of go at it at different directions when we use survey data. Social trust of other people, is one element of social capital, perhaps the most important component of social capital. I know that Robert Putnam has argued that before.
Mm-hmm.
And so it goes into that, at one component into that thing that we call social capital. It's kind of the glue and the grease that keeps relationships moving, keeps the economy moving, and that's the reason why, as economists, and as you said, many different disciplines, sociology and political science, that's the reason why we're interested in it.
In terms of economics, why does trust help to keep the economy moving?
Trust has been related to basically, I think the easiest way to see it is to think about the efficiency of transactions.
Mm-hmm.
If we trust other people, it reduces transaction costs. We don't have to have a contract for everything. A handshake may work. We believe that when we scan our credit card or our debit card for a transaction, we believe the transaction will be completed, and so does the vendor. And so it makes that transaction very, very low cost. Because it's low cost, we conduct more transactions. There's not efficiency losses. And in that way, it stimulates the economy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see how that works. If I, say, for instance, over eBay, wanting to trade baseball cards for spark plugs with somebody, and I don't know who they are, I don't trust them, I might have to send out a private investigator, and that's going to cost me a whole lot, and I realize, well, that's not worth it, so I'm not going to engage in the transaction. But if we have some mechanism to guarantee that trust, yeah, why not? I'll trade you, and I assume that in the next week I'm going to get the baseball cards, and I'll send you the spark plugs, right?
Exactly. There's also been some studies around finance that indicate that the people who indicate that they, through survey data, they are more trusting, they tend to invest more. They have more faith in the financial markets. They tend to undertake their own investment and invest a higher amount. And so that's all good for the economy.
And I can imagine just thinking about the past 2 years and all the news about financial scandals and Bear Stearns collapsing, et cetera, that social trust can wane and wax over time. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was really the key thing, at least for me, out of Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone. His main point was how over time, as there's less and less kind of direct interaction between people, the social capital would be declining. And that's kind of the point of his, well, even the title, Bowling Alone.
Right. Let me go ahead and kind of investigate this topic of trust a little bit further in terms of, we'll get back to the issue of whether trust has been declining or increasing in society a little bit later, but let's explore that topic of social trust a little bit more. I think I'm going back to Mark Granovetter's pioneering study back in the early to mid-1980s. He was a sociologist, and he was started to talk about two different kinds of trust. He called these strong tie trust, or what is oftentimes called bonding trust, and weak tie trust, which some people have called, I think Putnam has called it, bridging trust. Now, what's the difference between these two types of trust, bonding and bridging?
Yeah, I also know in that literature it's also been referred to as thick and thin. And basically, we have two different kinds of trust, and this was really kind of, I think, the most important contribution of Bowling Alone was to specify these two different kinds. So the bonding, or this thick trust, or the strong tie trust, is where you have really, really strong trust among people that are in your immediate network. They're like you. You know them well. They're in they're in your community. And that's, it's all trust. So it's all very good. And so that particular kind of trust, we would see really kind of manifest itself more in smaller communities and enclave communities and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The thin trust, or the bridging trust, or the weak tie trust, however you want to call it, that's where our trust is spread out a little bit more. We are more trusting of people who are outside of our immediate network or outside of our immediate group. It's sometimes been said as being a more worldly, a more global view of trusting other people. So we're more apt to trust people that don't look like us, we're not familiar with, or they happen to be a stranger. And that's basically the difference between the two.
And I think going back to what we were talking about earlier about trust in the economy. It's that bridging trust that becomes very important. For me to engage in a transaction with a total stranger, I really have to step outside of my enclave and say, yeah, I've never saw that person before, but yeah, I think they're worthy of my trust and I'll invest in them. Is that right?
Yeah, but I go a little bit farther than that. Really, both forms of trust are important.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, when we have we go into a recession, and you know, you've probably seen a number of different pieces on this. When we went into recession, and people are looking for a job or just an opportunity to work. More often than not, when we're in this recession, they're turning to these immediate groups where they have really strong trust among their members, and that's the first place they're looking for a job.
Uh-huh.
You know, when someone in your parish, their home catches on fire, it's your parish that's first there to provide clothing and food and some temporary housing. And so those are, you know, that contributes an awful lot as well. So both of them are very important. And as we move along, I know we're going to talk about how different organizations kind of, so to speak, generate this trust. They're not mutually exclusive. When we take a look at let's say we're going to talk about a religious denomination later on. They're probably generating both types of trust. It's just which end of the spectrum are they closer to?
When you talk about this, and I'm going to back up a little bit. When you mentioned the social bonding trust and how if your house catches on fire, your parish comes around. We did have a really great podcast with Michael McBride on this, talking about Mormon organization. They're an organization that are incredibly good at creating these kind of bonding networks. And so I'm going to refer our listeners back to that. We'll put some links up on our website so you can visit it there. Now, in terms of talking about how trust is generated, created, and or maintained, there have been a number of theories about that out there. And in your paper that I'm referencing today, you talk about individual theories of trust and societal theories of trust. What are the difference between these two explanations for how trust is generated in society? Let's go ahead and start with individual theories of trust. Where does trust come from?
Yeah, there's some theories that these are two very broad categories. And in terms of the individual category, it could go all the way to the roots where it's in your DNA. And so nothing in terms of your external environment is going to affect how much you trust another person.
Yeah, we just all seem to know somebody who's really trusting no matter what.
Yeah exactly. Also in terms of the individual, if we were to empirically test things, it's a little bit easier to explain that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's really these individual characteristics, demographic things such as male, female, race, have you ever been discriminated against, so on. Some things that are really kind of directed at the individual themselves. The more societal or community theories of trust is that trust is generated when we interact, specifically when we interact with other people. So it's more like we're a blank sheet of paper, and then through our interaction with people, we either have higher trust or lower trust, depending upon what the interaction is.
Let me back you up for a second and talk about those individual characteristics, because you piqued my attention here. What are some of the individual characteristics that sociologists or people who study this have found? Is it men or women who are more trusting? Is it the poor? Is it the wealthy? Who tend to be more trustworthy on this, trusting, I should say, on this individual level?
One that's really clear, you asked about the poor versus the wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
Income is really, really clear. As Putnam put it, the haves trust more and the haves not trust less.
Mm-hmm.
And the economics behind that is if I have less, if I'm in a precarious financial situation, let's say, and I put my trust in you and you violate that trust, I have much more to lose. If I'm wealthier and I'm not in a precarious financial situation, I put my trust in you and you violate that trust, my security is not, you know, my own financial or economic security is not in that much threat. And so it's basically, I can afford to be more trusting if I have more assets and more wealth. So that one's pretty clear. The difference between men and women, it goes, I've seen similar theories on men and women as well as race. It tends to be groups that have historically been discriminated against in the marketplace tend to be less trusting in terms of market transactions and so on.
Okay, I can see how that would be, you know, fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, I back away.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and move to the societal theories now, because this is going to take us to religion, being groups of individuals here. And in your paper, you mentioned three somewhat distinct theories of how trust may be generated at the social level. And we're talking groups here, and we had started talking about that a minute before I had interrupted you. So continue on with that stream of thought. Where at the social level are we generating trust, or how might it be generated according to different theories?
I would basically, to me, I break it down into really a couple categories. And one is kind of voluntary association. So, in other words, I'm sitting on a bar stool next to you at a local pub and we start up a conversation. That kind of impromptu voluntary association with someone else tends to be something that builds trust.
Mm-hmm.
The next time I sit in a pub, I'm more likely to talk to the person sitting on the stool next to me. It's kind of the, I bump into someone in the line at the grocery store and have a conversation with them. It builds trust. And that's a little bit different from the association theory. That's where we participate through an organization. So you and I are coaching a little league team. Now, we had to make a commitment to do that. And so we joined this association, and that's how we interact with each other. And through that interaction, that builds trust of other people. So here you and I are, the only thing we had in common is that we've got a kid on the little league team. So we've met someone we've never met before. We work with them. We learn to trust them or distrust them, and it affects our level of trust. There's been other research into this third branch. So you mentioned three. So in the work that I'm talking about today, it's the main focus is on those first two. This third branch on community theory really puts more emphasis on the characteristics of the community within which I live and less on the individual. So do I live in a big city or small town? Do I live in a city that has a high rate of crime or a low rate of crime? Do I live in a city that has high income inequality or low income inequality? Is it very homogeneous or very heterogeneous? And so some studies have emphasized that particular the community characteristic.
And could that, in terms of religion, also imply the different types of theology or organizational factors in different denominations?
Yes and no. The interesting thing about these various theories of trust is that they're not, no one's really arguing that they're mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would kind of think that they're all at play to some degree or another. So, for example, in our paper, you know, we don't say it's the social and not the individual. We basically say we need to account for both, that some of it is individual characteristics and some of it is social characteristics. So I think that the association theory comes to play with religion because the first thing that we do is that we choose to participate in a church. So we're standing next to someone in the pew on Sunday. We have a conversation at the bake sale afterward. So we voluntarily join this association, and we're interacting with people that we may not know. Could very well be that, you know, we find out we have mutual businesses and we do business together, whatever, but, you know, we chose to join an association and we're participating with people. The second part, the community theory, where that emphasizes the aspects of the community, now we chose to join a specific denomination and it has very specific characteristics, and those characteristics then can have an impact on our trust. So it's my opinion that using really what social scientists have put forward in terms of these societal theories, the association theory applies to religious participation or attendance at church, and the community theory applies more to the specific denomination that we belong to.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that we want to explore a little bit here, because the findings of your paper in many ways surprised me. And I start talking about religion and bring that into the equation here now. I mean, as a casual observer of religion, I would tend to think that religion would enhance trust in society. First, you know, most major faith traditions and denominations really teach the virtues of extending a helping hand to your neighbors, of loving thy enemies, of exhorting people to bring others closer to God. So for, at least for me, it would seem that religion, whether you think about it in terms of religious belief or religious practice, that would be something that enhances trust in a society. What are your thoughts on that, as just this casual observation about religion and trust?
Yeah, I agree with you completely, because you know, here as individuals, we're participating in something with other people. It should be building social trust. The difference is that I interpret the question that you just asked as that, you know, you're really looking at religion and assuming it's always building, bridging social trust, and bridging social capital.
Right.
Or this kind of thin trust. So I guess, you know, Mark and I, our argument is that there are two dimensions. There's the participation in a church, regardless of the denomination. And there is participation within a specific organization, which is the denomination. And so when an individual participates in their church, that church is building both kinds of social trust. The thick and thin, and the bridging and bonding is building both, because they're not mutually exclusive, but it's a matter of degree. And so some may build more bonding and some more bridging, so less bonding, more bridging. So it's not one or the other, it's what's the balance between the two. The theory behind this actually goes back quite a bit, and I think it was Carino had an article where he specifically talked about the culture of fundamentalist Protestant churches in particular. It really kind of emphasized this point where kind of the fundamentalist approach historically had been really to build a tight community to kind of hold back encroaching secularism,
mm-hmm.
and to maintain the customs and traditions of this religious-based community. Now, so in that environment, what is built is an enclave community. So a very tight community. And again, they're building social trust, but it's really trust of the people that are within that specific network. You know, you really have the back of the person who's in that church with you. And so, as I said before, that's very positive, but it's a very different kind of social capital. And it's focusing more on working with the people in that very specific community, that enclave community, and less so outside the enclave community. On the other hand, liberal denominations, let's say liberal Protestant denominations, there's been more of a focus on we're part of the, you know, the greater world, you know, more focus on all different kinds of peoples across the world and outside, you know, quite a bit outside of our social community and outside of our denomination.
And that's, for me, this is really fascinating. When you talk about fundamentalism, I can fully understand that. When you're drawing away from society, you're setting yourself off, creating higher tension between you and the world around you, it's going to be a little bit more difficult to have that bridging trust, and one could just see that you're going to have many more interactions with the people around you as you move into your enclave, so bonding trust. In terms of liberal denominations, you have that, well, let's go out to the world and meet with them. But here's an interesting puzzle that I really can't wrap my head quite around, is that these more sect-like churches that we might think of as withdrawing into enclaves, they're fundamentalists, your Pentecostals, Mormons, for example, those are the churches that tend to be growing much faster than your liberal Protestant churches, the United Church of Christ or Presbyterians. They're not growing as fast. And it would seem to me that if you are a church that wants to evangelize, to proselytize, and to grow, you would want to emphasize that bridging capital aspect of it. So what's going on here?
Yeah, I agree with you. It's one thing that we all have difficulty with when we do our empirical studies is how exactly do we slice and dice denominations down?
Mm-hmm.
It's very messy. It's very messy work. Mark and I, in this paper, we followed what NROC does, Tom Smith and his group, when he and you really use the categories of conservative, moderate, and liberal. And that's far from perfect. And the reason why is this angle of do we emphasize being evangelical church in our approach? That's missing from our paper because we just simply aren't able to kind of categorize denominations that way. So that's a shortcoming. When you talk about these conservative churches growing, there are some sect and very, very, very conservative churches kind of going to the point of Ioniconi in terms of, you know, we have big hurdles you have to cross to be part of the community.
Yeah, wear special clothes or behavioral norms.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, that's making sure that we don't have the free riders, making sure that, you know, the people that are in this church are committed to participating and so on. And those are important, but they're not necessarily the ones that are growing. Now, that in mind, that I've just kind of countered a little bit of what Ioniconi said, but there's another category of what we would have deemed as conservative Protestant churches, which have this evangelical approach, and they have focused on growth. And I understand your point where you're saying, geez, if you're going to bring these people in, you know, you must really be, you know, building bridging capital. You know, you must really be building this bridging trust. I think there is some of that, but I think there's still the emphasis on the very strong tie network. So I'll refer to the interview that you did with Mark Vonderer where he talked about mega churches and in particular he talked about their use of groups. So in these growing churches, a growth strategy has been to pull in someone into a small group in within the larger, you know, mega church even, a growing organization, but to focus on that small group, build that small group trust, and then we move that person along to as being a member. So we introduce them into a small group. We've got something of a common interest with people. And that's what I think this particular work ties in to Mark's philosophy on this megachurch growth strategy.
Right.
Now, I hope that makes sense because I'm trying to paraphrase Mark's theories on megachurch strategy.
No, it makes a lot of sense. In fact, that was one of the most fascinating aspects of that podcast was how these megachurches looked at. On the outside, they're very inviting. Come on in, you're in your pajamas, we'll give you a coffee, and you can kind of sit here in the back, and everything's cool. And you're like, well, you know, how can a church like that survive if they have such a laid-back attitude when we know that churches that tend to flourish tend to have more conservative or strict behavioral codes and requirements associated with them. But as he pointed out, once you get the people in the door, once you extend that bridging capital to them, they come in and there's a very intense effort to formulate that bonding capital, especially if you've been around for a few more months and say, hey, yeah, I see you around in your pajamas every Sunday, so why you're interested in horseback riding. Why don't you come to our small horseback riding group? We do a little Bible study and on Wednesdays and we go out for a ride in the country. And that's what really starts to tie people closer into the church.
Yeah, and I think he's, I think his point on that, I thought that was an interesting interview, and I think his point on that, you know, really hits a nail on the head.
That's kind of interesting. So in terms of your empirical work on this stuff, before we talk about your findings in specific, and we've already hinted at what some of these findings happen to be, how do you go about and study this? How did you actually try to figure out what religions are more trusting or what religious people are more trusting? What were your methods here?
Yeah, Mark and I had actually, we came to this work from a different angle.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing research on individual attitudes toward international policies on international trade and immigration and so on. And that given our backgrounds and our interests, both of us being at religious-based schools and so on, what caught our attention was during one of the election cycles, there was a lot of reference to making a connection between the Bible and biblical passages and economic policy. So I remember one in particular in South Carolina where a politician said, the Bible tells us to take care of our own. We shouldn't be so concerned about trading with other people. You know, we shouldn't be opening up our doors to immigration. We need to take care of our own. We need to take care of ourselves. And so we thought that's another very important cultural aspect that may be affecting people's attitudes to conducting international trade, you know, trade with economic transaction with a stranger, or allowing a stranger into my community and allowing them to assimilate into my community. So we looked at denomination and religiosity and to see if it had a connection with those attitudes, and indeed it did. And so we found that very interesting. It was a successful line of research, but we felt like there was a big gap. So we found a connection between religion and attitudes toward international trade and immigration, but we didn't really explain why. And so we felt that Putnam kind of helped fill the gap for us in that it comes down to social trust. How much do we trust other people? That's going to have an impact on, am I willing to undertake a transaction with a stranger? Am I willing to allow a stranger to immigrate into my community? And so we felt that social trust was the link between the two. And so we basically took the same empirical framework we had when we were looking at these attitudes toward policy and took the same set of variables and applied it to a question, a survey item on trust. And so we used the general social survey data from 1975 to 2000. And it was important for us to use a long data set. One of the reasons why is that we really didn't want to use national election data, 1 year of data, because if we took denominations and broke them down into subgroups, we really wouldn't have enough people in a group to really have a viable estimate.
Right.
So we need to have a large pool. Second, it strikes me that you could very well have, you talked about trust waxing and waning.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine during an election cycle, when one politician is saying this about the other politician and it's getting really ugly, the social trust could likely drop off. In other words, an election year might actually be an anomaly. It may not really represent a longer-term pattern.
And that's a good point, because a lot of political scientists, including myself, really rely upon the National Election Study, which is a very comprehensive data set. But again, you're right that it is a very specific moment in time, and it's pump-priming people to these rather divisive political debates, which could have an impact on how they represent themselves at other times, non-election times.
Yeah, and then the third reason is that we wanted a long time period because, you know, Putnam indicated in Bowling Alone that, you know, he thought that social capital would be declining over time. We want to see if that was the case. So by using that general social survey data, we captured election years and non-election years. And so we're able to pool that together. So we used that data, and we included a number of variables that would get at individual characteristics, so the individual theories, and a number of variables that would get at the societal questions. So when I had talked about that, I said, we do not believe that those are mutually exclusive. We think they're all at work to some degree or another.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the reason why we included variables that would capture both.
Okay, and what were your findings here when you ran you gathered all the data and you ran all your regressions and stuff? What did you find?
In terms of some of the individual characteristics, you know, we had just the standard outcome. So when it comes to gender and race and education level, income level, marital status, all of those had standard outcome that, you know, both Mark and I had shown in previous research and other people had shown. And it was actually a lot of research on that. So it appeared in a number of papers.
So basically the individual theories of social trust generation seem to bear out in that regard.
Yeah. Standard things like if I'm divorced or separated, that you expect me to have a lower level of trust of others. You know, I mean, that's a pretty straightforward one. So all those straightforward results we have.
Right.
What we added to that then were our denominations, Protestant and Catholic, Jewish and other. And so those were four main categories. To try to get at religiosity, we included attendance. Now, of course, there's going to be the our study's not perfect because we're constrained by the data quite a bit. Attendance is a very common way to get at religiosity. So how much do I participate in that faith?
Right.
So we use that in terms of our, for our association within churches. There are a couple other things that we ran in there for community variables as well, such as the region of the country, some things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Our results for religion were pretty interesting. First, there was a paper by Alessina and Lafar a couple years earlier where they had indicated that religion has no impact on social trust. However, one criticism that we have of their paper is that they did not include religiosity. They did not include a variable such as attendance. They also only kept two broad categories of Protestant and Catholic. And so there's a long line of research that shows that within Protestant, you have a lot of different denominational effects, a lot of heterogeneity within Protestant, and also that attendance or religiosity is important. Well, that's not to criticize their work. Their work was very important because it focused a lot on community aspects, such as racial homogeneity and income homogeneity.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really kind of what their emphasis was. So as soon as we took their paper as a starting point, as a nice template, because they had, first of all, they had found and stated in the paper that religion did not matter, and that they specifically said that they were surprised by that. So the first thing that we did, we included attendance into our results, and as soon as you include attendance, you start getting some significant results. So for example, Catholic now becomes a statistically significant result. And so we simply attribute that to a missing variable bias mm-hmm. in their results. We also believe that there's a missing variable bias in their results whenever you aggregate Protestant altogether and you don't separate out very, very different traditions such as Black Protestant and the conservative or fundamentalist, moderate, and liberal.
Mm-hmm.
So if you aggregate them together, you have a missing variable bias, and so you really shouldn't put much faith into your results. So our second step was to separate out these denominations and from Protestant in particular. So we had Black Protestant, fundamental and Pentecostal, moderate, liberal, and then, of course, we still included Catholic, Jewish, and others.
Now, were you able to separate out Black Protestant from Pentecostal? Because there might be some overlap there.
Best that we could.
Okay.
And you're correct. What happens is that in all of these categories, there's some overlap.
Mm-hmm.
And we walk through in these denominations and try to do the best that we could using the documentation and literature that's available to us. And, a lot of that has been documented by, various different organizations and is available for researchers to use.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in separating the Pentecostal out from fundamentalists, there's so, the religious tradition in the United States is so rich and there's so much heterogeneity, it makes it really, really difficult. So we spent an awful lot of time on that, tried to do the best that we could to make sure that we've accurately categorized these variables. And so when we do that, we begin getting some interesting results. In particular, the Black Protestant, fundamental, and Pentecostal traditions have a lower level of social trust than our benchmark group, and the benchmark group would be that group of people who do not profess an affiliation with any particular religious denomination.
So secular individuals.
Secular individuals, correct. Yeah, and I wouldn't call them, they're not atheists or anything like that. They just don't profess an affiliation with a denomination.
Right.
And so the social trust for those three groups was lower.
Mm-hmm.
We found marginal results for Catholic. I assume you might ask me a little bit more about that. And we found very significant results for attendance.
Yeah, I'm going to have to ask you more about that because you are at Marquette University, after all, and it is Jesuit, so you're going to have to justify that result. But in terms of what you're measuring in terms of social trust, in your variable of social trust, do you think you're really getting at the bridging capital or the bonding capital more?
I don't think we're getting it either precisely. Mm-hmm. Some other work that we've been doing uses the social capital benchmark survey, and in that they're more specific on who do you trust. So in other words, they'll ask questions like, do you trust your neighbor?
Mm-hmm.
Do you trust the person you go to church with? Do you trust your coworker? And in that way, you're able to kind of compare trust within a specific group versus a question that is just simply overall, do you trust others?
So that's the question that's being asked in the survey, do you trust others?
Yeah. For me, if I were to answer that question, I think I would associate it more with bridging trust rather than bonding trust.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking when I was reading your paper as well, because the others are those people in the town next, you know, town 10 miles away, or, you know, immigrants who've come in to that extent, and others. You usually don't talk about others as your neighbors or close friends or members of your congregation. But that's
exactly.
Only guessing at that, right? As you mentioned, you're absolutely correct. The data doesn't really let us slice it up that finely.
Exactly. So I think the results that I'm giving when I say lower level of trust, I really think it's more directed at this bridging trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the result on attendance is the one that convinces me of that.
Tell us more about that then.
Yeah, so when we've got all these controls in the same model, and we look at something like attendance, we really mean what's the effect of attendance regardless, or holding the denomination effect constant.
Mm-hmm.
So regardless of what denomination they are. So it's the general effect. And that was highly significant and positive. So in other words, the more I attend church, regardless of what church it is, the more I trust other people. At least I've indicated that in the survey result.
Right.
And that's a very strong result. There's a parallel here with Putnam and Campbell in their new book, American Grace. They focus, specifically in that book, they focus on these various dimensions of religious participation. And in their chapter on social trust, they argue that it is this attendance or participation that's important and not denomination. We're a little bit different, where we say they're both important, but the most important one is attendance. And so Mark and I really came away from this paper saying it's kind of like the strongest effect and the most important effect, trumps everything, is attendance. And so that really supports what we talked about earlier, this association theory.
Mm-hmm.
It's that I am in an organization and interacting with other people, which is most important. So the denomination effect comes second. And the denomination effect, we expected to get differential results across, to keep it really simple, let's say fundamentalist, moderate, and liberal. We expected the fundamentalists to indicate they're less trusting on the survey item, and the liberal to indicate that they're more trusting. Then our benchmark group, which is a secular group, as you call them. And in general, our results show that. And moderate ended up being not significant.
Mm-hmm. So there was this big difference or significant difference between liberal Protestants and, say, the more conservative, fundamentalist type of denominations. You do something in the paper where you actually calculate out what this effect is or how much it really matters in life. And how what do you find there? I mean, is this just a little tiny bit? Is it a big bit? How would you classify that?
Of course, the effect varies across the different groups because, you know, they just have a larger beta or a smaller beta. And, yeah, the effect's pretty important. And in some of the simulations that we did, we pulled out what were some of the more important demographic characteristics, such as education. And we kind of compared the impact of religion on trust with education on trust. So we know in all the research that education is really important. The higher the level of education, the more trusting the person is.
Right.
And everyone seems to be pretty comfortable with that. You know, if I take a young person and I put them in college, they're going to get a much, much broader exposure to other people in college with this, achieving a higher level of education. And so they're likely to be more trusting.
Mm-hmm.
And we find that religious denomination has an effect that is up there with education. So it is pretty important. Again, remember that there's a difference between the denomination effect and the participation effect. So the participation effect is really big. The denomination effect is very large for Pentecostal, say, for example, insignificant for moderate, small for Catholic. Catholics seem to be fairly sensitive to how we set up our model. So it just kind of depends on the denomination, but it's right up there with some of the more important determinants of social trust that's been accepted in the literature.
Yeah, so what you're saying essentially is attendance really tends to build trust among individuals, but then the denomination can have a tempering effect of that. So if you're participating a lot in a Pentecostal denomination, you won't have as much trust as somebody who's participating as much in a liberal Protestant denomination. That's correct?
Correct.
Okay. And what about the Catholics? How do you explain the Catholics here? And as you mentioned earlier, you have to justify this a little bit since you are at Marquette University. So what's your thinking on the Catholic effects that you get?
The Catholic one is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, in the literature, there have been a number of people that have talked about how Vatican II would have an impact. After Vatican II, much more of an emphasis on we're part of the larger world.
So moving in a more liberal Protestant direction.
Exactly. And so that would tend to change this effect that we would find among Catholics. It's kind of difficult to pinpoint, was I 6 years old when Vatican II happened,
mm-hmm.
and then it has an impact on me, or was I 20 years old when Vatican II happened, and that has an impact on me? So we had to move the age, you know, to put a dummy variable in there to control for Vatican II, we kind of had to move it around. But there's an additional problem as well in that there was just an awful lot happening in society, a lot of cultural changes going on in the United States around the same time period. Okay? We had the 60s. So, big cultural changes. And so, of course, this is a social science. It's not neat. We can't separate those out. In addition to that, when we were doing our work, say, for example, on immigration, I remember some work that Andy Jungert had done on Catholic social thought and immigration. And the Catholic Church takes a very strong, very clear-cut position on immigration, and that is every individual has the right to immigrate in order to earn a living and support their family, and that's a right that no government should bridge. And so it's a very clear-cut policy. When we looked at Catholics and their attitudes toward immigrants, we don't necessarily find support for that. And I remember asking Andy in particular, why do you think that's the case? And his comment was, how many Catholics really know the position of the Catholic Church on immigration? That's just not something that's filtered down to the pew.
Right.
So the Catholic was difficult. I have a sense, although statistically it didn't bear out very well, I have a sense that the Catholic effect was kind of washing out. I would put it, the wash out, moving it more toward moderate and kind of leaving Catholics in the middle ground.
In part might be because of the Vatican Council II effect and just age effects in there, that you have a, you know, different age cohort of the people that you're asking and such, and as well as all these other confounding factors that it's very difficult to control for in that. Let me talk about the issue of time series, the issue of whether or not trust has been declining or increasing or staying the same in society over time. Again, we go back to Putnam's Bowling Alone, and that book released, I believe, in about the year 2000, 1999 or 2000, raised the alarm bells that social trust in the United States is basically going to hell in a handbasket because we're no longer in bowling leagues anymore or such. What do you find in terms of social trust? I mean, you make a concerted effort to really include a set of survey research results or a data set here that extends roughly a quarter century from 75 to about 2000 or so. So what do you find?
Yeah, we find in terms of this one variable that we're measuring, social trust, and I say it that way because, you know, I do want you to take a little bit of skepticism. We find that there is a general downward trend.
Mm.
And that holds when we're talking about the aggregate population within this survey set. It doesn't make any difference, you know, what denomination or how much they attend church. In general, we see a decline in social trust. And so in that sense, you know, we kind of support Putnam's work.
Do you think that in any way is being tempered or washed out by the fact that many more people are starting to go to conservative denominations or maybe increased by that? Because there has been a move since the middle part of the 20th century away from the traditional mainline liberal denominations toward more of these Pentecostal denominations, Assemblies of God, and such. And as you mentioned, the effect of these denominations actually tends to put a little bit of the brakes on religious capital after we recognize that attendance has a big impact on it.
This is what I like, is being a scholar and a researcher, and the answer is, I don't know. There's so much going on right now. I think one of the really, really interesting things that I think there's a couple different interesting trends that are going on in the religious marketplace right now. You know, one is this increased switching. And so over time, we see individuals behaving more and more as consumers in the religious marketplace. And, you know, as you know, there's been a lot of work on that. The second is kind of what's happening within the Catholic Church. And Putnam and Campbell made a very strong point on this in their new book, American Grace, where basically the traditional white, historically European individual has been leaving the Catholic Church, while through immigration there's more and more participation on the part of Hispanics in the Catholic Church, to the point now where whites are a minority within the Catholic Church. I think they indicated we fit the tipping point on that. There's a big demographic change there. In terms of these conservative churches that you're talking about, you know, we have the more sect-oriented, very, very conservative, and we have the mega churches that are growing and really pulling in a lot of people, and they are affiliated with, you know, what we've considered a conservative denomination. But they don't really emphasize the denominational aspect. Now, in those churches that are growing, if I talk about the mega church, I don't think, if I'm sitting at home and watching TV and I'm watching one of my Sunday morning pastors, I don't really think that builds the kind of social trust that we're talking about. If I load my family up in the car and I drive out to the mega church and we park the car in the parking lot, hang the speaker on the side of the car, and watch the service on a large screen TV, I don't think we're building social trust. So there's a number of different dimensions, a number of different things that are happening that kind of leads me sitting on the fence. So in terms of religion, sitting on the fence. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think you're absolutely right. That's one of the fun parts of being a scholar, is that we can constantly be generating a new research agenda as we go along with this. And your research has raised a lot of questions for me. There were some unexpected results, the denominational effects I didn't necessarily expect when I read your paper. And as I was going through your paper too, I was a little bit skeptical. But as we've talked through this, I can kind of see how this is really all playing out, and you know, connecting it with the work of Iannacone and others, and thinking about this difference between bridging capital and bonding capital, and how that might play out. It does tend to make a lot of sense, and I think that is really interesting. Let me just finish up here and go back to another paper that you had talked about, and we had hinted about this at the beginning of the podcast as well. Is talking about how this actually plays out in social policy. So, you know, for most of this podcast, we're talking about trust, and it's this free-floating concept that's out there. And, oh, scholars are very interested in that. But as we mentioned at the beginning, this stuff does have some very specific implications for policy, for economic behavior and such. And you and Mark had done a paper on something called God and the Global Economy, and looking at how different religious groupings, denominations, attendance, and such played out in terms of support for trade, for free trade, and for immigration. And if you could quickly encapsulate what you found there and how that might relate to the trust paper, I think that'd be a great way to finish up and put some meat on this.
Yeah, so if you take the trust paper, which I said, if you think about it in terms of research, I think we did things backward.
Yeah,
I think we should have done the social trust paper first. And that would have laid kind of a little bit stronger sense, a theoretical foundation for the trade policy and immigration policy paper. So if you take denominations where the level of trust affiliated with that denomination was lower, so the Pentecostal and the fundamentalist, what we'd expect if they're less trusting, and if we believe that that trust question is really kind of getting at the bridging kind of trust that you and I had talked about, we would expect that the individuals in that type of denomination would be less inclined to trade with other people, people from another country, from another religious background, say, for example. They'd be less accepting of an immigrant coming into their community, someone who's bringing their a very different cultural background and religious background.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what we found in the paper, that the more conservative Protestant denominations tended to oppose policies on immigration and trade, whereas liberal denominations were more supportive of increased trade and immigration. And once again there, statistically what we did is we simulated the impact of those results, and it basically was of the same magnitude, or in the case of some denominations, a little bit larger than the educational effect. And we know education is very, very strong determinant of attitudes toward those kinds of policies. So we found some very strong results.
And that all adds, for me as a political scientist, that all adds up to some very interesting political ramifications, as your conservative fundamentalist and Pentecostal organizations tend to move toward the right end of the political spectrum, where Republican Party has largely been a party of free trade in recent years, but yet they have this large cultural group that is supporting them that has that suspicion of it. And again, this all gets mixed up in the immigration issues as well, depending on, you know, who wants immigration coming in, whereas Democrats have been much more friendly in recent years toward open borders and allowing more immigration, and where Republicans have tended to side on the opposite end of that issue, although there's a small grouping of them who've been interested in bringing them for business reasons. So it really makes for some interesting political science to go on here, and a lot of research still yet to be done, as you mentioned here. So, Joe, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion here and joining us. We're going to keep track with your work and the work of Mark Vonderwerf, because both you guys, I really respect your work quite a bit, and we hope to have you on in the near future.
Well, thank you, Tony. It's been a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.